John Follis, welcome to the Justin Geary podcast, my man.
Thank you, Justin. Pleasure to be here.
It is an honor to have you on this show, man. I've interviewed some cool people, but this conversation and your background, your story, your resume, if you will, like, I'm like, dude, I cannot wait to have this conversation.
Oh, great. Well, thank you for saying that. I appreciate it.
Yeah. You know, one of the first things that when I look at someone, like the way they title themselves, like there's so many different routes and we have like these long things of things we could say about our works and what we've done. But the first words when I researched you and when I found you was creative director. And that word creativity is a word that's always like stuck out to me. And I think what I want to start out with first and ask you is, what does this word creativity mean in your life?
Oh, wow. What does it mean in my life?
I'll say right now, like, you know, right now.
Yeah. Well, for me, it's kind of like the lifeblood. It's kind of my essence being creative. Because from my earliest memories, creativity was just a way for me to express myself. And yeah. I think a big part of that was that my mom was a art teacher. So she only taught for a couple of years before she got married and started focusing on a family. But growing up, I was essentially, me and my sister and I were her art students. So when you're only a few years old and she throws a box of crayons at you and says, let's see what you can do with these. I guess because of that, it's always been part of my DNA from my earliest memories.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing about creativity is it's like, I don't feel like there's anyone that gets out of this life without tapping into some sort of it. Like to be human almost is like to understand creativity. It's like in you, but not everyone makes a profession out of it, right? But from early ages, like we're all inclined towards some sort of creativity as children. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, you know, there's always been a debate. I've heard it asked occasionally, is creativity something you're born with, or is it something you can develop and you could learn? And I guess it's kind of a combination of both. I think anyone could learn how to get in touch with their own creativity, but like most things in life, some people have natural talents in certain areas.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I would say it's kind of a combination in both. But, you know, I think anyone, if it's something they want to develop, they can certainly do that just by focusing on it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, there's so many routes. I feel like just thinking here, talking to you, we could go. And I think where I'm like being led to ask is like, for a lot of people listening, like they feel creative or they have creative projects, but there's always like the voice that's like, well, artists don't make money, or like my creative endeavors don't produce income and I need money in this world, you know? So when did you like make a decision? Like, yeah, like I think I want this to be my road, my life, or was it just always like going to be that?
No. What you just said was always my attitude. You know, I'm creative, but now I got to figure out what to do for a living.
Yeah.
So, I, unlike some people, I had really no idea what I wanted to do. I knew I was good at things like drawing, but I didn't want to try to become a professional illustrator or painter or anything like that. So I went to a liberal arts college. And 2 years into it, I was starting to get nervous because nothing was really standing out to me as a career path to take. And it was only the result of taking a class at this university, maybe the only creative kind of class that this liberal arts university offered was some kind of graphic design course. And of course I took that, and I was doing really well in it. And about two-thirds of the way through the class, the instructor asked me to stay after class to chat with her, which is usually not a good sign.
Yeah.
But her question to me was, have I decided what I want to do with my life?
Wow. A teacher asked you that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I didn't know why she was asking me that. She, her response was, because I you're incredibly talented. And she said, I would just give you, if you don't mind, I'd like to give you some advice. I would definitely try to pursue something, a career, some kind of career that enables you to take advantage of your talent. Mm-hmm. And my advice, if, you know, you want to take my advice, I would suggest that you get the hell out of this college. Wow. and choose another college that's got a better curriculum with more courses that would allow you to develop your talent.
Mm.
So that was really a turning point for me, because I asked her what university or college she had in mind, and the one that she mentioned was the one that my dad happened to graduate from.
Oh, that's cool.
And he was the guy paying the bills. So
love it.
I mean, there's a lot of colleges and universities in the country, right? So the irony and coincidence of her picking the one that my dad graduated. So that was
this is Syracuse, right?
That was Syracuse University. Okay. Exactly. Wow. Right. Yeah. How did you know that?
Oh yeah, man. Just looking at your bio and stuff. Yeah.
Okay.
Words. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, good that you did check out my, I guess that's on my Wikipedia somewhere.
Yeah.
So, once I transferred to Syracuse, still, Syracuse had a cornucopia of curriculum that you could define as creative.
Hmm.
I mean, they had architectural design, fashion design, industrial design. I didn't even know what industrial design was until I learned, well, this is how you kind of create objects and things. I said, oh, that's intriguing. Hmm. So they had curriculum and things that I didn't even know existed.
Hmm.
Sports photography, journalism, all kinds of things, including advertising.
Yeah, man. Nice.
So I went to Syracuse with my portfolio, basically from this one class, some graphic design work. And I presented it to a guy who I thought was some kind of a student guidance counselor to get his advice as far as which direction, what kind of courses I should take to explore any number of creative channels. And they give you these cards to fill out for the courses. And he took a couple of minutes and filled it out and handed it back to me. I looked at it. And everything had to do with advertising. It was like advertising concepts 101, advertising design 101, advertising typography, advertising. Huh. Everything was advertising. And he said, now take it over to the woman over there. And I took it to the woman. I said, who was that guy I was just talking to? He was a counselor, right? And she said, oh, that's John Sellers. He's the chairman of the advertising department. And I remember going back to him and I said, listen, sir, with all due respect, I don't know that I want to go into advertising. I want to explore different things. He said, kid, if you're creative and you want to make money, you go into advertising. Now go back to that woman and give her this card and get set up.
Ah, that's good. That's how you fell into creative work within the advertisement world.
And Justin, it did not start out well for me because I didn't mention this in what I shared with you, but you start out taking a basic advertising 101 class. And I think at that point, I was starting my third year of college and the program at Syracuse was a 3-year program. Mm. So I had a lot of catching up to do. If I continued, I would have had to go to summer school. I had to take extra courses to make up for lost time. So I couldn't afford not to do well. And I think you needed to get at least a B average to continue.
Okay.
And I started out with this instructor getting C pluses and Cs and then C minuses. And as the course continued, my grades just continued to get worse and worse. And I was really freaking out.
Yeah.
And part of it was the fact that I just did not like this guy.
Hmm.
I just did not like him. And the frustrating part about it was that like a number of instructors at Syracuse, they would somehow convince guys from New York and Madison Avenue to actually come up to Syracuse to teach. So he wasn't just some local advertising guy. He was a working professional from New York who was teaching. So when this guy tells you you suck, you kind of have to take his word for it. And he basically told me I sucked. And with about 3 weeks left to go in the class, he said, listen, you don't really get advertising. And I'm going to tell you something right now. I'm going to give you a choice. You could continue the last 3.5 weeks of the class and settle for whatever grade I'm going to give you, which I can't tell you. All I can tell you is that it's not going to be a good grade. You're not going to like it. Or you could drop the class right now and get an incomplete, like you never took the course at all, which to me was not much of a choice.
Yeah.
And I'm not a guy that quits easily. But when someone presents you those two options as a choice, it's really not a choice. He was basically, without saying it, telling me he's going to flunk me.
Yeah.
And, you know, when my grades were so bad, clearly I wasn't in last 3 weeks going to do enough to turn my grades around, all of a sudden get a B average. So I vary with much frustration and concern about my future, ended up dropping the class. So that was not a very good start. My ad career could have easily ended right at that point before, you know, it really started.
Yeah, man. This story is good. You know, I thought you were just going to say, I went to Syracuse and graduated and everything was good. And then I hopped into this job in New York.
Right.
I love the drama and I want to say the failure, because I feel like later on, it's going to help you so much in your career as we get through this story. But I can imagine you're in like a really low season right now. You're like, do I even want to do this work? What's next for me? Where does the light start to trickle in when you're like, I think this is me. Like, I feel a calling, you know?
Well, it was like a gut punch. Hmm. It was really like a gut punch, because any class that I had taken throughout my elementary, junior high, high school education, I would get, the lowest grade I think I ever got in any class was like an A minus. I even got a couple of A pluses in, you know, art related design classes.
Yeah. Wow.
So to be told by an instructor of a class that is theoretically going to be my career direction to tell me that I suck so bad he's going to flunk me was something I just, I didn't understand.
Yeah.
And, fortunately at Syracuse, they had multiple instructors teaching the same course.
Okay.
So I decided, when I looked through the course catalog, I realized that I would have the opportunity, if I chose to take it, to take the same course with a different instructor and hope for a different result. And fortunately I did that, because that's exactly what happened with a different instructor. I had a feeling it had as much to do, or more to do, with the fact that the instructor and I just did not get along than it had to do with my talent. And fortunately that bet turned out to be a good bet, because I think I ended up getting like an A minus with a new instructor, and, you know, continued on to graduate.
Yeah. So far I've picked up on three distinct characters. So the first one is like, you're too good to be here. Like, you're amazing. And then the second one is like, you suck. And the third one is the one you vibe with and you get the A minus. It's interesting.
Right.
I'm waiting for more characters. Who comes next?
Well, that's one of the stories that I included in my video series, Two True Stories in Advertising, which are 9 different short video stories from my career. And even though that was really at my advertising career, I felt that it deserved a story. I didn't go into detail about this situation. I don't know that this podcast is appropriate, but the story goes into a little more depth than I just described. But anyone could watch it. But so that was the start of my, you know. So then I graduated Syracuse, and then the question was, now what? And I was afraid of New York. I grew up outside of New York, a couple hours in Connecticut. And was not a city guy growing up and was just kind of freaked out by the whole vibe of Manhattan. Mm. So unlike a lot of my classmates, I didn't want to go to New York, which is where, you know, the holy grail of advertising, as you may know, is Madison Avenue, New York City.
Yep.
So anyway, I started out, one of my instructors had worked in Atlanta for a couple of years and said, you're crazy for not going to New York, but if you want to go to Atlanta, I could give you some names of people to try to get meetings with. And that's what I did, and did 2 years in Atlanta and felt like things weren't moving quick enough for me. Then went to Chicago for 3 years. And then after 3 years in Chicago, I felt I was ready for the big leagues and moved to New York when I was 27.
So it's like you had the opportunity, but you didn't want to go just because of the whole stigma of NYC?
No, I was just scared shitless. It scared the crap out of me.
Like the idea of being around like the big guys, or just
I'm not a city guy. I grew up in Connecticut in a very bucolic environment, very laid back, and I was a very shy, introverted kid.
Gotcha.
And so the times
stripes, you feel like.
What's that?
You had to get your stripes, so you went around.
Yeah, I mean, New York, to someone who isn't used to it, I just remember going in when my dad used to take us in to New York to visit. Very intense. I mean, it's just everything is really moving fast. Things are loud. People are saying, fuck you, you asshole. And, you know, it's very aggressive.
Yeah.
And I just didn't think that I was ready to, despite my talent, that I believed in, I didn't think my personality, I thought I would get my ass kicked, basically.
Yeah. Okay. Got it.
And I actually did when I ended up moving there a few years later. I did get my ass kicked multiple times because I had got fired 4 times in the first 7 years of my career.
Okay. So when you come back, you leave Chicago, you come back to NYC, you begin there. That's when you get your ass kicked and you get fired 4 times in 7 years.
Well, I got fired once in Chicago, the other 3 times in New York.
Got it.
And all in the first 7 years of my career.
And this is just working for advertising agencies?
Yeah.
Okay.
Working for big corporate agencies where I thought the most important thing was, if you're a creative person, was how talented you are, only to realize that that's only a part of it and a much smaller part of it than I thought it should be. The big part of it was how good are you at dealing with corporate politics, which I sucked at.
Yeah. That's, I hear that often with different fields that people go into. They come in with the purest mindset of what the actual craft is about, and then they encounter all these things and they're like, they get really turned off by it. Especially as an introvert, I can imagine, like at the time as well. For everyone listening, can you just describe like what a creative agency does, these creative agencies that you were working for with advertising?
Yeah, they do just really, This was in the 80s and 90s.
Pre-internet, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, a good part of it was. I mean, I'd say, you know, I was actively working until maybe 10 years ago. So, I had a website that went up in 1996. So I was I was podcasting in 2006. Unlike a lot of people said, you know, this is only a fad. I said, I don't know that I totally understand this, but I gotta check it out. Smart. So I didn't switch off my brain and my focus when the internet came around, like a lot of my peers. But to answer your question, a creative agency ultimately does really great work for the client, advertising work for the clients that pay them to do that. And the clients, the companies, big agencies, you get a lot of national and international brands. Like I worked on Volkswagen and Pizza Hut and Coke and Dial Soap. And, you know, at these big agencies, you get a chance, not all the time, but that's what these big agencies have. So a lot of that is TV work. Mm. And again, because it was pre-internet, digital media didn't even exist. So it was the most of those big clients' budgets went to TV, but then there's a fair amount of print and maybe radio and outdoor billboards and things like that.
Got it.
So they just do a really good job. You know, so the reason that a big brand is going to select an agency is creativity is a very big reason for them to choose an agency, because the logic is the more creative their work is, the more it's going to be seen and liked by the people you're targeting with your message. You know, people respond. The reason why people talk so much about Super Bowl commercials, they rank them. You know, after every Super Bowl, there's a big ranking. Everyone's talking about, well, which commercials were the most creative, because people like creative commercials. They get a kick out of ones that are really creative or funny or entertaining.
Yeah.
We're all human beings. We like to be entertained. We like to be engaged.
Yep.
So the agencies that have the ability to come up with advertising, whether it's TV, radio, print, outdoor, whatever, that does that really, really well, are the agencies that I wanted to work at, you know?
Of course. When I think about creativity and advertisement, here's what's going down in my mind. Like, something can be very creative and ingenious, but it never gets seen, right? And so this is where the advertising comes in, right? So I think about like a product that's like amazing, but it doesn't get any shelf life, right? And then I think about a product that's not that creative, but it'll eventually sell. Because what we want is to sell. So how much of what you were doing was like creativity and then putting it in front of the masses, you know? Because Super Bowl commercials, if they're all up there, it's the creative one that wins. But there's a lot more creative ones that never got there in the first place. You get me?
Yeah. Well, you're talking about media budgets. The media is the channel that allows the commercials to connect with the audience. And there are media planners that sit down with the client and with the account executive and occasionally with the creative people. They should always involve the creative people, but they often did not. But they would sit down and figure out, well, what's the marketing, what's the business strategy, what's the marketing strategy, you know, based on whatever the product is, and then figure out, well, what are the best media channels to reach that audience. So that would be determined up front.
You know,
you want to be on this TV show at this time. You want to be on the, you know, if you're selling shampoo, you want to be on daytime TV talking to women, running on Oprah, whatever is daytime soap operas, right?
Yeah.
You know, if you're selling car batteries or you know, double bacon cheeseburgers, you want to be on football games or NASCAR or something like that.
Got it. Okay. So all that is determined beforehand, and then a budget is set aside for it. We're going to throw this amount at it. And then once they have all that set up, they're like, all right, let's get creative. And that's where you.
Yeah. So as a creative person, you get a brief and you say, okay, here's your creative brief. You've got to come up with a TV campaign that's going to be running on football games, targeting men 18 to 35 to blah, 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 to try to convince them of this and this and this.
Got it.
And then we would have to sit down. You'd have an art director and a writer. I started out as an art director, but the way my training was at Syracuse, which is one reason it was such a good school for advertising, is they train you to think, whether you're good on the design side or the copy side, conceptually. So sometimes, even though I'd be working with a writer, I'd come up with a headline. And sometimes a writer would come up with a visual execution idea. So a lot of it was, you have to be kind of ambidextrous creatively in that sense.
Yeah.
But you basically get thrown together, and in a couple of weeks, you'd have to come up with some ideas that you would then present to your creative director to see if he would, you know, give it a thumbs up or a thumbs down.
Yeah.
And it was very competitive because sometimes they would have a lot of the same teams working on the same assignment. So
they would choose the winner.
Right.
Oh,
so yeah. It's like being in a cage with, you know, three or four hungry lions, and they throw in one piece of meat.
Yeah.
Who's gonna survive. So
That's so I why, didn't know this. Okay, so
this is why it gets so political, you know
what
I'm saying?
Yeah. Oh, okay, see, that's a big eyebrow I know for other people listening, is we think that based on what you said, that it's your gig. Whatever you come out with is John's work. But here you're saying there's like four other Johns, and right. three of them are going to get tossed in the trash, and one of them is going to make it.
Well, remember the show The Apprentice, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I love that show because in many ways, in fact, many of the assignments were marketing assignments, if you remember. And they would always have, I'm trying to remember, at least a couple of teams. They would have two teams, I think, in every case.
Yeah.
Where they would sometimes maybe more than that, but it was always based on a competition.
Yep.
And that's the way agencies worked. Not every agency, but I would say that was pretty much standard business protocol.
Yeah. Isn't it fascinating how like it's art and it's creativity and it's like, it feels like it's free, you know, and, but then you bring in that level of competition and it changes art, you know, and it's almost like, cause I come from a sports background. So like playing in the street, playing hoops, whatever. And then like, that's all fun and dandy and like the beauty, cause you love it. And then it becomes competitive and then you have to win and lose and it changes the sport. But I've never thought about that connection with art, but it makes complete sense. Do you feel like it made you more creative, or were you just like, I'm in my zone, I'm going to do me? How does that go down in your mind? Cause I hold my work so personal, and I'm sure you do too, as a, you know, as an introvert. I mean, tell me.
Did it make me more creative? No. It made me more competitive.
Okay.
Because what it forces you to do, Justin, is realize that it's just not only a matter of coming up with some great ideas, but then selling your ideas.
Yeah.
It's the salesmanship. So you quickly realize that just because you think you have the best idea doesn't mean that whoever you're going to be showing it to thinks the same way.
Yeah.
So a big part of it I quickly learned was how well you're able to present / sell your work.
Yeah. Which has not much to do with creativity.
Well, in the lingo, I would disagree with that, because you have to think of what to say.
Yeah.
And just like I think the best salespeople are guys who are creative and know exactly how to say things that are going to, you know, get the reaction that they want.
Yeah,
you have to be really creative when you're going in there, and you basically, you know, in 30 seconds or 60 seconds, you got to say something that's going to have to get their attention and get them to be curious.
Yeah. You got to take your work and what you came out with and then make sure that you win his heart over.
Exactly.
Yeah. That is creative. And
that was a whole skill set that they don't teach you in college. So I had no training in that at all.
Yeah.
And you quickly realize that you better learn how to do that really, really well if you want to survive, because you may even have the stuff that's creatively better than your competition, but they're just better at selling the work than you are. And they're gonna, you know, if they're better at that, then chances are their work is going to get chosen.
Yep.
And, you know, if your work doesn't get chosen at a certain point, you're not going to be working. You're not going to have a job for very long.
Yeah. Wow. So do you come up when you do these projects, like with your team, and you always show up with them, or do you get new team members every time? You know what I mean?
It's not a team. It's one partner. You are paired up with one person.
Okay.
So you go in with your partner.
Okay.
And, no, you don't. You know, if you really develop a good connection, with someone in the agency, then I think you can try to pitch, to your creative director that you guys want to stick together.
Okay.
But that's not a determination that I was usually in control over. Usually they would just match me up with people that sometimes I got along with them, but in many cases, just did not get along with them so well. It's really tough.
Yeah.
When, you know, it's like anything where, you know, you're having to do something and you're not necessarily a good fit for one another, and that can make it really, really difficult.
Yeah, like any endeavor. When you talk about these corporate like bends to the whole thing and the inside, do you just mean like for this world specifically, like, oh, I know the director, I got this? Is that what you mean?
I know you mean the creative director that I'm presenting to?
Yeah, like the whole corporate thing, would it be just like my connections and they're going to
Are you asking me if I ever felt that way?
Well, no, I'm asking like, is that what you mean when you talk about like, when you said earlier, I wasn't too familiar. I didn't really know like the whole corporate side of it all. When you say that, do you just mean like people knowing other people and getting connected that way?
No, knowing the dynamics, the internal dynamics of an agency and the idea, I mean, basically the things that I just shared, that you've got to not just come up with great creative ideas, but a big part of it was selling it, presenting it.
I see.
And a lot of it has to do with how well you got along with your creative director. Mm. You know, it's all relationships. And if you had a good relationship with your boss or your creative director, that made it much, much easier to get work done. And those that really kissed up to the creative director and had, for whatever reason, just were tight with their creative director, were usually the ones that for some reason their work always got sold. And you know, and again, it's a lot of it's personality. And I think that's true in any corporate environment, be it advertising or any industry. But when you're in a field like advertising, where so much of it hinges on presenting your work and so this, you know, the salesmanship of it, I think that's one thing that makes it a little bit unique. In that, you know, the personalities and your relationships are that much more important, because that's such a big part of it.
Yeah.
Get them, because you want to get them to give a thumbs up, you know, in the work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So shifting back to your story. So you're here, you're bringing out this competitive side to you. I'm sure you're getting some deals or some work and they're approving it. Others you're getting nixed. How many years does that go on for? Does it become like, I'm going to start my own thing?
Yeah. So, here's what happened. I mentioned I was fired four times, two of the times, and these are all top agencies, really good agencies. So at least I can look back and say, well, you know, before I got hired from these top agencies, before I got fired, they hired me. So it's not easy to get hired at these good agencies, but two of the occasions, Justin, the guy who hired me and wanted me to work with him, that's why he hired me, I was going to be working with him, left for another job within 2 months after bringing me in.
Damn.
So all of a sudden, the reason I was at that agency, the guy who brought me in and the reason I was hired at that agency was no longer at that agency. So all of a sudden, anyone in that situation, I would say, at that point is extremely vulnerable, because they've got no one watching their back.
Yeah.
They've got no one who's there who wants them to be there. And often you'd be seen as the bastard child that no one really wanted. And it just made it more difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. I can imagine. Shit. Wow. So seems like you got the big break, you're working on in New York, and then you're getting fired. And
yeah. And so it wasn't until after, you know, multiple times finding myself going down into unemployment and trying to get another gig, that I started freelancing and just trying to get whatever project work I could get. And a lot
kept you in the game, John? Like, was it just the love of it all? Because I mean, hearing your story now, like thinking about it, like I'm like, most people would probably just stop. Like, why?
Yeah.
What made you keep going? Like practically.
Well, believe me, there were a lot of long nights where had difficulty sleeping because I was trying to figure out what was wrong with me. Why it just did not seem to be working out.
Yeah.
And I couldn't help at that. You know, after the third and fourth time, reflecting back on the words of my college instructor who told me basically I sucked and I didn't have the talent to be successful.
Yeah.
So it was not easy, but then all of a sudden you realize you got rent to pay.
Yeah.
And, you know, unless you want to go crawling back to mommy and daddy, yeah. which yeah. I did not see as an option.
Yeah.
You say you got to get your ass back in gear and find whatever work you can get. So, you know, that's what I did. And, yeah. and you know, at a certain point you say, well, okay, well, maybe I'm not going to get hired at the big sexy ad agencies, but maybe there's some smaller, more obscure agencies that might benefit from me and be impressed by the fact that even though I didn't last long, that I did work at these big agencies, and maybe they would be impressed by that on my resume and be willing to give me some project work, which is what happened.
And that's where the freelancing came in.
Right.
And that gave you like a whole new life surge, would you say?
Yeah, because suddenly it tucked the corporate politics out of the success equation.
Mm.
When they just bring you in and you're only going to be in there for a few days or a week or two to solve a problem for them, there's really no politics.
Yeah.
They just want to see what you could, they just want to know how good you are and what you come up with creatively to solve the problem.
Yeah.
So in a sense that was like a whole sense of freedom. I felt like unshackled from these, you know, political, to not wondering who I need to smile at in the elevator and all that stuff, you know?
Yeah. It came back to the whole reason why you wanted to get it in the first place.
And what I was good at, you know, I really felt like it, you know, my reasons for getting fired had less to do with my talent than to do with my circumstances and my, and, you know, just because the guy that hires you leaves the agency doesn't mean that you're destined to be fired. But you, at that point, you really have to have good political skills, because that's when they really come into play, when the guy that's watching your back is not around anymore. Mm. And I didn't really want to focus on trying to be good at politics. It didn't come natural to me. I didn't like it. So I didn't really try to put a lot of my energy, because a lot of it was, to be honest with you, I felt was ass kissing.
Yeah.
And it just went against my grain. And I wanted to be respectful of everyone.
Yeah.
But I just saw, you know, a lot of people really go up the chain of the internal structure because they were just really, really good at ass kissing.
Yeah.
And anyway,
digressing. That's a good word, because I just think it's true for every industry. And we could go deeper in there of why that works and why top leaders even receive it, because that's a whole dynamic there. Why that even still is successful as a method? Why does it keep working? Because there's problems in the system. That's another conversation. But I want to get into some of your work. I think would be a cool place to go. We could shift the conversation there. Man, so many questions. What would you say is the work you're most proud of? It doesn't have to be the most successful, probably the most I am so glad I did that.
Yeah. Well, advertising can be a pretty shallow business. And, you know, at the time when I was in my 20s, I was all about wanting to work at the best agencies and winning awards and all that stuff. And, you know, now that I look back and I say to myself, did I really help make the world better by doing the best commercial for fish sticks?
Oh, that's good. Right. John.
Right. The reason I mentioned that is because pretty early on in my career, I realized that where maybe I could make the world better with my talents was to do public service advertising. And so I got involved pretty early on in my career, my 20s, doing various nonprofit assignments for various causes and things like that.
Okay.
And throughout my career, that I really enjoyed doing that, because whenever you're doing advertising that really can make the difference between life and death of someone, or you know, their health or someone like that.
Yeah.
That then all of a sudden it really becomes much more meaningful.
Yeah.
Much more satisfying, right?
Yeah. You see, I want to ask you this though, or maybe you could give me your observation. Not everyone feels the way you do about their work. And I don't know if we all should, but some people are just there to get the job done and collect the paycheck. And for some reason, there's a group of people that they want their work to have meaning in the world. Why do you think some people feel that way, like yourself?
I can only speak for myself.
Yeah, of course.
Otherwise, I'm just, you know, just my opinion, which really doesn't mean much. I can just say for myself, when I was 25, I got hired at what I think was the top agency in New York. I could not believe that they actually hired me there, and I was thrilled to work there. And the one of the founders of that agency, a guy who I respected incredibly, had a bunch of quotes that I would really soak up. Because they were such words of wisdom that seemed to go beyond advertising. They were about life. And one of his quotes that ties into your question was, it went something like, the advertising people in the United States are the most skilled communicators in history. Wouldn't it be incredible if we all used our skills toward helping solve the world's problems? Imagine the difference it could make.
Nice, man.
And when I read that quote, like, I got goosebumps.
Yeah.
And I was like 25 at the time, and that was just one of, you know, several dozen quotes that he read, but it went so far beyond advertising. And for whatever reason, it really resonated me, because I thought he was absolutely true.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe it was when I, you know, after a few years of working on products that I felt, you know, may or may not be that great for people, because, you know, sometimes you know, to work on Coca-Cola is a very prestigious account to work on, but as a nutrition guy, you know, that drinking soda water is not very healthy.
Awful. Yeah.
So, you know, when you kind of start realizing that that's a big part of your job, then all of a sudden the idea of doing something for more meaningful causes can really be an exciting concept.
Yeah.
So I actually framed that quote and had it up on my wall. So it just kind of reminded me of that. And ever since that time, I would get involved. And about 10 minutes ago, Justin, you asked me a question, which I'm trying to get to, because it ties in with this idea.
Beautiful.
So I came up with, on my own, just one night I was watching TV, and I came up with an idea based on something I'd seen on TV for a child abuse prevention ad. And it was pretty outrageous, because I was watching a documentary about Adolf Hitler, and it mentioned that Hitler was abused as a kid.
Wow.
And that kind of was like one of those mind-blowing facts that didn't surprise me once I heard about it, but I had not heard about it prior to that documentary. And I thought, gee, how can I leverage this fact and turn it into some kind of an ad that's going to get people, that's going to be really creative and get people's attention and get people to go, whoa, you know? So I came up with an ad, showed it to my partner at the time, who was blown away by the ad, and said, let's try to sell it. One thing led to another. And we ended up meeting with the National Committee for the Prevention of Child Abuse, who, even though they were based in Chicago, happened to be visiting New York because they were working out some kind of a business deal with the NBA. And we didn't know why they just said, listen, because my partner called them up in Chicago. We didn't want to just send them the ad. You know, again, talking about salesmanship,
if possible,
you want to get a face-to-face. So I don't know what we would have done if they said, well, just send us the ad. But it just so happened that the timing of his call coincided with the fact that they were coming to New York for this business meeting with the NBA and said, listen, why don't you meet us at the NBA offices in 2 weeks when we're going to be there? And you could show us this ad and we could have a conversation. Now, we did not know that the reason that they were meeting the NBA was that they were trying to get the NBA to donate some of their TV time to run national TV commercials promoting child abuse awareness.
Wow.
We didn't know that. We just knew that they were talking to the NBA about something and we were going to go and present our ad. Wow. So we presented this ad that I had come up with on my own, and they basically said, I don't think that's going to work for us. However, would you guys be interested in doing a national TV campaign for our organization that the NBA is going to be running during their playoff games? And we
said, what year was this?
This was 91.
This is Jordan's era.
Yeah, it even might have even been pre-Jordan. Okay. But yeah, yeah. No, it definitely was Jordan because, yeah. So the stipulation, the NBA, David Stern at the time was the new NBA commissioner, and he really took the NBA to another level because he was very PR and marketing savvy. He's an attorney, but he realized the value of good public relations. And he knew that if he wanted to get more people to watch the NBA and like the NBA and get good press, that they had to figure out how to incorporate causes that that the NBA could identify themselves with, you know, back to school, education, don't, you know, stay in school, you know, stuff like that. So it might have been because of his leadership that they got involved with this. But all we knew is that we had like 3 weeks to come up with a national TV campaign that the NBA was donating over $5 million worth of their TV time to. So $5 million in 1991 is probably worth 10 today. Hell and yeah. I'm not talking $5 million a year. I'm talking $5 million for 4 weeks. So whatever we came up with was going to be seen repeatedly by anyone who was watching NBA playoffs that year.
Oh, John, this is amazing, man.
So, I mean, I've always been an NBA basketball fan. So the idea that it was up to me to come up with a campaign dealing with a cause that I really believed in, that the NBA was going to run, it was going to be nationally seen by anyone watching the games. And the one stipulation the NBA said was you have to involve our players somehow. Now, what they were leaning toward, and they didn't come out right out and say it, but I think they had done some stuff prior to that where basically they got one of their players reading a script, you know, off a whatever you call it, and basically just, you know, talking head to camera.
Mm-hmm.
Reading some script that the agency came up with. And I said to my partner, I said, if that's what we're going to be forced to do, I don't want to take this assignment.
Yeah,
and fortunately he agreed with it.
Yeah.
And at the meeting, when they asked us if we were interested, I was really, I'm glad I said it. I guess you could say it took some balls to say it, but I said, listen, we'd love to, you know, we love the cause. We love the NBA. But we also love great advertising, and this is what we're good at. So
that's badass.
If you're going to dictate to us what you want the creative to be, and you're going to say it's just got to basically be one of your players on camera for 30 seconds or 60 seconds, you could find another agency. And I guess what worked in our favor, Justin, is they had their back against the wall because at the time, I think the playoffs were literally just 3 weeks away from going. So they couldn't fuck around. Can I say that?
Yeah, you're good.
they couldn't fuck around with, and I think they realized, because they had seen some of our other work, at least the national committee had seen some of our other work, and they, you know, it was pretty much their decision because we were representing them, even though NBA was giving us their media time. So yeah, they said, that's fine. I said, just somewhere in the commercial, it's got to have something to do with the NBA. So my challenge was, how do I come up with a concept that is really effective of raising the awareness of child abuse prevention and somehow tying it into basketball?
Yeah.
And I had like 3 weeks to come up with it. And so that was the challenge, but I came up with three spots. And, you know, I said, gee, so I'll tell you about one.
Yeah.
So child abuse, right? Mm-hmm. You're imagine being a little kid, you know, how tall are you when you're a little kid? You're 4 years old, 5 years old. You're what? 3.5, 4 feet tall. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
You look up to your dad. He's going to look like, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, right? So do you know who that is?
Yeah. Okay. I got you.
So maybe I can somehow make an analogy here. What if I got one of the tallest basketball players and came up with a script that somehow made the viewer realize how intimidating it could be for a little kid, for a father to like be angry at him. Wow. Never mind be abusive, but just be aggressive, or, you know, potentially, even if it's just potentially abusive, just the size alone.
Yeah.
It's got to be extremely, extremely intimidating. So maybe that's the tie-in I can do with a big player. So we got a player who was 7'4", and I started the camera. This was 30 seconds. And I said, I want to start the camera looking at his feet. And for the whole 27 seconds, all I want the camera to do is very slowly, with a slight fisheye or wide angle, basically just slowly tip up, you know, with a slight wide angle. So it looks like the Empire State Building, right?
Yeah,
if you're looking
yeah.
up. And by the time the camera gets up to his face, that, you know, looks like it's, you know, 40 feet high, I want the guy to like lean in right into the camera and say this line: if it makes you nervous to have someone my size in your face, imagine how your kid feels when you're in his. And then it just cut to a line that says child abuse. No one wins with child abuse. And then there was an 800 line, 800 number to call for more information about child abuse. That's all it was.
Yeah.
If it makes you nervous to have someone my size in your face, now your kid knows how, you know, what it feels like to be in his.
Yeah. 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 So the buildup was the raising of the camera.
The whole, you don't know what it is. You're watching, you're switching channels, right? A commercial comes on and you just see, and there's like this ominous music. We hired a music composer and we said, we don't really want music. We want like some kind of they call it sound design, where you just come up with this, like, you know, like sometimes what you hear in a horror movie, right? When there's a horror scene about to happen and there's just this, you know, that there's something intense happening.
You'd
hear that and you just see that. And so if you're walking away to, you know, get a sandwich or something, you look, you're like, what the fuck is this? And then you get the payoff, and it just that. So that was one of the three that we came up with.
Oh, that's cool, man. That is cool. And I love how the whole thing happens, because you go in with this expectancy of something, a work you wanted to do, the one with Hitler and stuff that you presented. And then it's like something even better came out of the whole situation, but you lost something, but like something better came.
Yeah. And
it's fascinating how like this has been a theme in your life, now that I've spoken to you for 45 minutes or so. Like you got punched by this teacher who said this, but then you lost something and you left that agency, and then you went to do freelancing, and that actually gave you more life and set you up for the rest of your future. And it's like, that's such a cool theme that I see.
Well, let me tell you the rest of the story, Justin, because this is pretty awesome. Not many people get honored at the White House. Right.
Yeah.
So I think after a week and a half, we got a call from the VP of marketing at the NBA. And he said, I just want to tell you guys, your commercial is going great. He said that I can't tell you the positive response we've been getting from people all over the league and everyone we talk to, because anyone who's watching these games see these spots, and we're getting great coverage in national newspapers and everything like this, you know, which was great to hear. And then about 3 weeks after the campaign completed and the NBA championship ended, I get my mail one day and I get a letter that has the White House as a return address on it. And I think, well, this is a clever way to get my attention. And I open it up and it's an invitation from the First Lady saying, oh, we'd like to honor you for your work for child abuse prevention. We'd like to invite you to a White House reception, you know, next month. You know,
and the First Lady was at the time, this is 91, right?
Right.
That was Hillary?
No, this was Barbara Bush.
Barbara Bush. Okay.
Yeah, George Bush was president. And apparently child abuse prevention, I think, was one of her causes.
Okay.
Which is how I got on. I still don't know how I got on the White House's radar, but I guess because the commercials were such a big hit, someone wanted to find out who created them, and someone, you know, mentioned my name, and that's how I got the invitation. So a month after they finished running, my partner and I were invited to the White House and part of this White House reception. And
yeah,
that has to be the biggest thrill of my career, because just everything. I mean, the fact that it was a great cause and it was the NBA and it was national TV spots, because I never got work produced when I was trying to, you know, working for the big agencies. I couldn't even get work produced, you know, never mind a national TV campaign and for a great cause like child abuse prevention. Yeah. So on every level. And here's the kicker, Justin. 6 months later, the ad that the child abuse organization rejected, we ended up selling to a local organization who said, yeah, that's a great ad, let's run it. And a couple months after they ran it, I got a letter from the United Nations saying, I'd just like to let you know that you are the recipient of the first ever United Nations Public Service Award. Can you come to the UN to receive your award?
Damn, this story gets better.
So, and within 1 year, I got honored at the White House and received an award at the UN. Same cause, two different ads, but I mean, it was an amazing year in my career. I'll just say that.
Yeah, no, I want to say this for everyone listening, like just picture John, like in his bed questioning life, like, do I suck? You know?
Right.
Is this worth it?
Right.
Like repeating words that someone spoke over him. And then picture him like listening to it, giving up, and none of this happens.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's just as blunt as I could get, because it's a story of overcoming, man, and continuing to believe, but more than anything, loving the work. I feel like you really love the work and then wanting to make a difference.
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone reacts to rejection differently.
Yeah.
The way I would react to it is it would make me want to work harder. You know, it's like being a player, in the NFL or the NBA. Where you think you have talent and you get cut. Well, you know, you've got a choice at that point. You could keep training and try to get an invite for another team and try to get on another roster, or you could, you know, teach third grade, you know, English, you know, nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
But deep down to your point, I really believed in my ability and I felt like I had something to prove.
That's good. That's good. That's something that I think it just comes out. You really figure out who you are in adversity.
Right.
Yeah. You really learn yourself. And that's really awesome to hear from an artist, because I know that for a lot of us, we're very like sensitive. And then when we feel rejection, we just go so inward and we never come out. And that happens to really good artists. And so it's nice it's refreshing to hear someone like, no, that's going to make me work even fucking harder. You know?
Yeah.
I love that. I love that. Yeah, man, John, this has been amazing speaking to you, bro.
my pleasure. I appreciate being on your show, because at this point, one of the things I love doing is lifting people up and inspiring people. And I just know that when I was struggling, sometimes I would just need to hear the inspiring words to kind of get me through the night. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So anything, any way that I can inspire anyone else by any, you know, my experience or my, you know, my wisdom from what I went through, I love doing that, which is why it's great that there are podcasts like the one that you have, where you have, you know, people that do that.
Yeah, absolutely, man. That's what we want to do here. And thank you for sharing your wisdom and your inspiration and just your story. It's really your message is your story, essentially. And thank you for that. Where can people can connect with you or learn more about your work? Or
I've got a shitload of stuff, digital content online. So I think if someone were to just pop my name into Google and spell it correctly.
Yep.
There's only one other John Follis who is dead, who has a lot of content. He's, I guess, made pottery or something like that.
Okay.
That's not me, but everything else under John Follis, you could probably, you know, maybe if you put in the word advertising, that would certainly bring it in. Sweet, man. Up my stuff. Yeah.
I'll link a lot of stuff here in the show notes. And again, man, thank you for your time and just for this message that was a ride, man. It was a ride, like the whole thing. But there were so many little truths in there, I think, that were extracted for people. So to everyone listening, thanks for listening to this episode. Please be sure to rate, review the show, and check out John on Google. Type him in. All right. See you next time, guys.